Welcome home. We are WNST, Towson of Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive, and a fresh homestand for the Orioles and a fresh Maryland Crab Cake tour for us. We'll be back down at Fadley's next Friday, but before then, we're going to be at Greenmount Station in Hampstead and Greenmount Bowl. That's going to be next Wednesday, the 24th. Then on the 26th, we head back to Fadley's, where this guy got a Pac-Man scratch off as well as a delicious crab cake and I think some shrimp salad to go. I never checked in on the shrimp salad, but I know how good the shrimp salad is at Fadley's. I don't even really need to check back in the fifth inning. Luke Jones joins us now. He was at Oriole Park at Camden Yards all weekend. He is our official appointee and representative to cover Orioles baseball. I've been watching Billy Joel get shut off in the middle of the night. What's going on, Lucas? How are you? Nice weekend down there. And certainly the young man finally got a base hit. At least get that off of him on a Sunday afternoon, start the week fresh, right?
Yeah, no question about it. I don't know if I'd say it was a nice weekend. I think it was a really rough weekend for the Orioles, quite frankly, until Sunday afternoon where they did salvage the final game. They did avoid a sweep. I came away impressed with the Milwaukee Brewers. I think they really hit the baseball. Corbin Burns after Sunday's game, which was pretty uneven performance for him, actually compared them to what we saw with the Royals with the last homestand. And we've seen the Royals play really good baseball overall since leaving Baltimore to conclude that first homestand of the season. So they were able to salvage the final game. Did not pitch well on Friday night. To your point, the shrimp salad was the highlight of Friday night's game for me because there was nothing else to write home about from an Orioles perspective. Saturday, not much better with Dean Kramer getting knocked around and the Orioles losing that ball game, although they hit a little bit better at the very least. But on Sunday, Burns wasn't bad, but certainly labored. I think that's probably the best way I would describe it. The defense, it's been choppy, as we've talked about with some of these opening couple weeks of the season.
You can't have your pitcher throwing the ball in the right field with the game on the line either. That doesn't help either, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I said, the defense has been choppy, and specifically Corbin Burns' defense was choppy on Sunday. But, they rallied, and it was great to see Jackson Holliday after a rough start, albeit four games. Let's pump the brakes here. Let's not lose our minds here about a 20-year-old being called up. Gets a hit right in the middle of a seventh inning rally, and the Orioles able to come away with the victory. So again, overall was not a good weekend. Be tough to say that after losing two out of three, but a nice finish to the weekend in avoiding being swept. And I said it last October, I'm not going to talk about this long sweep of regular season series without being swept when you get swept in the postseason, but I will at least note that it was good for them to come away with at least one game after a rough start to the series against the Brewers, who, like I said, I came away impressed and very much looking like a team that pitching a little more of a question, but they hit the ball. And that was even without one of their big guys as Christian Yelich left the game early on Friday. So impressed with the Brewers, but nice to see the Orioles at least salvage the final game of this set.
I was literally talking about the weather being nice over the weekend. It was certainly I didn't think the baseball went real well on Friday night. And it felt like a long time ago, but let's talk a little bit about that because you left me Friday night with Fadley's with shrimp salad and you were going down there. That was kind of a special occasion on a night where there was a lot of energy and all of that got taken out. Then you lose Saturday, you come back Sunday, you win, fine. The thing I would say to you, if I were beginning this from the top, aside from the weather and the weekend, which just sort of like they've been punched in the nose a little bit to start the season. They're not going to start the season 15-2 and jump out to a 6-game lead and everybody, it's not going to be that kind of race for them. And I think their pitching's not good enough right now for them to be a 101 win team as constructed, unless they hit the hell out of the ball.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, they're on pace for, I think, 97 wins right now. They're fine. They're fine in the sense of anything we've seen to this point hasn't really made me change my mind about how I felt on opening day, I guess is what I would say. And to that point, we talked about the pitching in a big picture sense. It's not as though it had been bad going into the first two games of this series, but when Tyler Wells struggles, when Dean Kramer really struggles, then there you go. I mean, you're going to have some issues when you get short starts for guys who are getting knocked around a little bit. So I mean, the Yankees are off to a good start. Let's call it what it is. They've played really, really high-level baseball early on. Now, are they going to stay healthy? They have all these veteran guys they're depending on. So that's the big question for them. But for the Orioles, I don't think there's anything to make a sweeping conclusion other than things that we already knew, right? I mean, the bullpen, for the most part, has held up pretty well, probably better than I thought it might have. Will that happen for the next 5 months after that without some reinforcements at some point? Who knows? I'm guessing they'll still need that. That's something I'm not going to change my mind about after 2.5 weeks. And
Well,
on the
better
flip
starting
side,
pitching leads to not needing as much relief, right? I mean,
correct.
that's right. And right now, my point on the 101 wins, I'm not being flippant. I just don't think they're going to go with this five-man rotation the whole year, unless they get cavalry, right? Like, and there's plenty of cavalry out there they could get. But I see Irvin and I see Wells. I see where Kramer is, and I've never been the biggest believer in Kramer. On his best days, he's looked okay, but I don't think he's ever going to be a Cy Young candidate. I think he's a three, maybe a four, right? I don't think he's ever going to step up and be a one or a two. If he is, this is the time to do it. He's certainly going to get some offense. They're going to hit the ball a
Well,
little bit, especially as it gets warmer out. But I just don't think they're going to need help to be an October team, and that's okay. I think we knew that in March, and I don't think Holiday's going to be overwhelmed at all, but I think. You know, they've scuffled a little bit. It hasn't been as easy as it was most of last summer, at least in the early going, where you just expect them to win every night and they're going to win. I mean, it's not going to work that way. It's baseball.
yeah, I mean, they've scuffled a little bit, but they're 9-6. I mean, 9-6 over a full season is 97 wins. So how much have they really struggled? It's baseball. And not you, in general, we all have to adjust to this every year because everyone, it's on the heels of Ravens and other sports, and then we come into baseball. It's like, oh yeah, they don't win every night. They don't win every single series. They don't sweep every single series. So
Despite what Big
other.
Poppy has with the hose, that you're going to win every bet and they're going to win every night because it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, exactly. So, from that standpoint, yeah, I mean, we know this, but the current state of their rotation isn't how they planned it and drew it up anyway, right? I mean,
Correct.
John Means has already made three rehab starts. He's up to about 60 pitches. So his
Oh, there's
return.
incredible optimism on those guys, right? I mean, they're not Tommy John. They're not where Felix Batista is. These are guys that. You and I, if we had to put a dollar in right now, we would bet at this point with Bradish. I mean, I feel it feels like he's going to pitch at least a little bit until his arm falls off. But it feels like both of these guys are going to pitch in Baltimore by June 1st. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean Bradish, I still want to wait and see on a little bit
Fair
because
enough.
I want to see him. I want to see him in a fully competitive environment, which he's going to make his first start this week. First rehab start this week at Bowie, from the way it sounds. So, Means is closer. Means at this point, it's not imminent, but I think if he's making a start within the next 2 weeks, that wouldn't be surprising. At the very end of April, very beginning of May, somewhere like that. And Bradish, I think it's more. Let's see what it looks like. Says he feels good. Says his velocity's good. We're taking them at their word for it right now. I mean, he wouldn't be in the clubhouse and throwing bullpens and getting ready to go on a rehab assignment if Tommy John surgery was imminent, for example. So we're just going to have to see. But he could get out there in a fully competitive professional baseball environment, even at the minor league level, and the elbow start to bark. And then they look at imaging and maybe they say the UCL's not in great shape. So, but the point is, they are nearing at least a return for John Means. This is, to me, much more of a meaningful checkpoint, inflection point for Kyle Bradish. Does that mean Bradish is going to come back and give them 120 innings this year? We're going to have to wait and see. I think that very much remains to be seen. But the overall prevailing point here is I feel like the rotation's been about what you'd expect, right? Burns, although he wasn't great Sunday, has been Corbin Burns. Grayson Rodriguez, for the most part, has looked like a number two or number three starter. Even Dean Kramer, he was bad Sunday, but his couple starts before that, he pitched pretty well. So I'm not ready to replace him, and I'm not suggesting that you were saying that either. Cole Irvin and Tyler Wells have been the guys that have looked like question marks, which is what we thought going in. So I've said it, going back to the offseason, I'd like to see Tyler Wells in the bullpen eventually. So, because I think he can help fortify them there, and I think he can be better there. In the meantime, they're doing what they're doing, and it's been choppy. There's no doubt. I mean, we've talked, Jackson Holliday, obviously off to a slow start. I'm not concerned about that just yet. Austin Hayes off to a really slow start. I'm not concerned about that just yet, although the way Colton Cowser's hitting, he should be concerned about that in terms of his playing time. But even someone like Anthony Santander, who had a really good first four or five games of the season, since then he hasn't hit the ball. So, you know, you're going to have the ebbs and flows of a 162-game season. You know, right now we're talking about guys struggling that at any other point in the season would maybe be a footnote, and that's about it. I mean, everyone's going to have their 2-for-20 kind of stretches over the course of 162. So from that standpoint, I it doesn't make for great radio, but I'm not going to sit here and really say that I have these grave concerns about them right now.
I think there's any concern about them at all. I just think there's been a humbling part of the beginning of the year for everybody that they had to have a couple of walk-offs. They won a couple of close games, right? You talked so much last year about
that's what they did last year, though. I mean, that's who they were last year, right? I mean, they came back. They had, I mean, we saw this in the second half of the season big time, Nestor. How many times did we say, my goodness, just think how great this team could be if they actually swung the bats in the first four or five innings? And that's kind of carried over. Everything about this team right now, other than maybe Colton Cowser looking like, for all this talk of Jackson Holliday and him being on the opening day roster and service time and him winning Rookie of the Year and getting the Orioles a draft pick, Colton Cowser's looking like Rookie of the Year right now.
Yeah,
so
I was going to say, is there a point with Cowser where I get over my skis? Because we're talking about a real lottery pick here, right? Like, do we look at him and look at Henderson and look at Rutschman and maybe a year and a half from now, he's the best of the three of them? And that's not to take anything away from the other two guys. But, like, he's got some real power. I mean, he looks George Brett-y. I don't even know how to say it. Like, just he looks like a guy that's going to hit like Markakis, but with power, more power. He looks like a guy that could hit 35 home runs and hit 55 doubles.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question with him, and look, I think I've brought up Markakis at different times. Cowser definitely has more swing and miss in his game and in his offensive profile, but to your point, and I wholeheartedly agree, definitely you see the power. I mean, we saw the power with the home run he had on the 3-0 pitch at Fenway last week, and we saw it over the weekend as well. Look, I think it's with any player, when they're as hot as he's been over the last week to 10 days, yeah, we're going to make those comparisons and wonder, but he's at the very least, including with the home run off of lefty on Sunday, he's looking more and more like a guy that, now, Austin Hayes should be concerned, not because I think Austin Hayes is going to continue to struggle to this degree, but Colton Cowser's hitting at a level, including against left-handed pitching, where it warrants him being in the lineup, not in a platoon situation.
Well, it forces
but every
a decision
day.
With Elias. He plays his way into the line. Because we've talked a lot about where the at-bats come from. Is it a Renicky Lowenstein thing? Is it platoony? What happens to Santander? What happens to Mullins? And to all of these guys, when the young guys come up and they hit, look, if Stowers would have hit the ball to begin with all of this, they'd have a bigger problem a year ago. Because this time a year ago, it's how could you send him down? And like, Cowser's come from nowhere. And this line of players, look, I was out at Chaucer having wings on Sunday afternoon. Oriole baseball's on everybody's tongue, and they're talking about players and talking about who, you know, what the, and they're mentioning May. I mean, they're talking about Norfolk players at lunch, as though 9-6 isn't good enough, as though Rutschman, Henderson, now Holliday, along with Cowser. I mean, it's an embarrassment of these ones that have come along in a way that you and I watch football, and all of these years, there's the Ed Reeds and the John Ogdens and the Ray Lewis's that sort of pan out. And I'm doing this for the 25th anniversary. There's some Kyle Bowlers and some Mark Claytons and some Travis Taylors that don't pan out. With the baseball team, because the odds are different and because baseball was a harder thing to project all along and because fans, quite frankly, didn't pay attention to the draft for the first 80 years of baseball, the last 20 years there's at least Baseball America. The TV network is a little bit more into it, but it's certainly not what we're going to see from the NFL next week in regard to looking at these players. But when they get picked, for all of these years, I go through – I mean, I'll go in the Wayback Machine. I'll be a real old guy, but you always say Jeffrey Hammonds. But I think about the Mark Smiths, and I think about just all of these first-round picks the Orioles had for 30 years. And they couldn't piss a drop other than Machado and Markakis, right? Like, all of these years. And And even that was 15 years ago now, 20 years ago now. Even with Wieters. Yeah, but I would say this, these ones working out in this org, this doesn't happen in baseball either, right? I mean, correct me that we've come a long way, that if you're taking eighth in the draft, that you're just willed to at least be a major league player, because the flame out rate in the first round, as much as we beat up these NFL general managers about flops, oh my God, a baseball the last 50 years, first round draft pick, that doesn't mean much. Being a top 10 draft pick means more, but that still doesn't mean that you get up the mountain. This last 5, 6 years of Elias, what they've managed to do in selection of players, keeping them healthy, and getting them to the big leagues, I mean, it's why they're 9-6, right? Period.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And really, for me, it's not even about the guys being picked 1-1 like Adley Rutschman or Jackson Holliday, or even someone like Colton Cowser, who was what, fifth overall. Look at Gunnar Henderson, who was a second round pick. Look at Jordan Westberg, who was technically a first round pick, but it was that sandwich pick, right? I think he was 30th overall picked. So it's not just hitting on the top five picks, but even that, to your point, teams don't bat 1,000. I mean, go back and look at the Houston Astros. They had a couple top five picks that did not work out, right? I mean, for every Correa and Bregman, they had it was Mark Appel, and I think I'm trying to think the other pitcher.
Well, Appel was a
I'd
can't
have to
miss guy.
look at
Appel
it,
was a
but
Strasburg kind of guy, right?
He was absolutely viewed in that light. So I mean, you have some of that, that you're going to have some guys that don't work out. And look, we still don't know exactly who's going to pan out in terms of being long-term dudes, long-term MVP candidates. So there's still some unknown, but the hit rate at this point, the way it's looking at this point, is extraordinary. I mean,
Well, they're
we
not going to
talked
have
about
any number one ones in the next 5 years around here. David Rubin's
certainly
not
hope not,
part of his
right?
ownership's not going to be getting any one ones.
The one thing I will throw out there, if you do have an off season, I mean, there's that lottery system that's in place now. So, if you have a down season, you could hypothetically still win a 1-1, with the
Explain that to
lottery.
everybody. I'm familiar, but barely.
It's a lottery. So I don't know all the numbers off the top of my head, but it's no longer just a guaranteed you're the worst team. And, it's like the NBA. The worst team in the NBA isn't guaranteed to get the number one pick. It's a lottery. I don't have the numbers in front of me
So don't tank.
with the percentages of it. Yeah, the point at this point, that was done to deter tanking, right? So that's where we are at that point in time. But your
Well,
overall
when a
point.
team is fielding 3-1-1s, you're like, did you tank, or were was that the plan? Because we certainly talked about it around here. So yeah, to some degree, if you field the 3-1-1s, it feels like you're doing it on purpose.
Well, I mean, Adley Rutschman wasn't done on purpose. 2018, they wanted to try to win one last time with that core. So not so much that one. The Jackson Holliday year, the year after 2021 when they lost 110 games. Yeah, we could talk
Well, it
about
speaks
that, but
volumes that you're trying and you finish last with a payroll.
sure. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean that's why whenever they received criticism from national media and types that have talked about tanking, the Orioles weren't a great example, quite frankly, because that all started with a team that had designs of winning in 2018, and they were just so terrible. It was so over. I mean, you could see it was over the last couple months of 2017, or the last month, I should say, because they were decent that August, but it was very apparent that it was over, and they decided to keep the band together for one more run, and it was a disaster. So the Orioles were never a great example of that because the system at that point had, Cedric Mullins, Ryan Mountcastle, Austin Hayes, Grayson Rodriguez, and DL Hall as high school prospects who were like 19 at that point in time. That was never a great example in terms of the overall question of tanking. Now, did Mike Elias rapidly try to build the major league roster from there? No, of course not. And frankly, he would have been dumb to do that because, okay, they could have lost 95 games rather than 110. What does that get you? What does that really get you?
Well, the
So
headline says intentional or incompetence. I'll go with incompetence for at least a little while until Elias got here.
it started with it. Yeah. It, no, it started with that. You're right. It
I
did.
saw
And
the
then
signs up in Korea that their scouts weren't allowed there. There was incompetence.
Sure. I mean, there was no question. I mean, we talked about the height of the Buck Showalter Dan Duquette era felt like a happy accident, you know, to borrow one of Bob Ross's lines way back when. But they were deliberate with what they did when Elias and Sig Meidel and the baseball operations side arrived in late 2018. They did not look at it through a lens of we're going to try to make this a quick fix and try to be competitive and try to win 87 games 2 years later to try to win a wild card. They looked at it and said, we're going to invest all of our resources into building up the farm system, building an analytics department, looking at it from a, you know, a technology standpoint, building up an international market presence, which is starting to bear some fruit over the last year or two. And to really be methodical about it. And if some people want to criticize that mindset, I mean, knock yourself out, but where they stand right now speaks for itself. And I think where we need to go back and recognize here, and again, this is a compliment to Elias and the current regime, that the Orioles, for all of the losing under, you know, go all the way back to the mid-80s, you know, even predating Peter Angelos as owner. Go back to the late or the mid to late 80s when the farm system really dried up and the Orioles were at a point where that their resource for talent for 3 decades was no longer there, was no longer bearing consistent fruit. From that point through the arrival of Mike Elias, they never really committed fully to rebuilding. You know, they'd have a couple years here or there. You know, Andy McPhail did a good job, for example, for a 3-4 year period that did improve the farm system a little bit, but they never fully committed to rebuilding the right way. It was always, you know, 3 toes into the water in terms of, okay, well, you know, we'll sign Jay Payton or we'll sign Kevin Millar. You know, like it was always those types of
Jeff
guys that
Conine, David
they
Segui. We can go through the whole era,
right,
right?
exactly.
Chris
They try
Benson.
they try to sign those guys. I mean, it wasn't just an era. I mean, again, it was 25 to 30 years of that where they never really fully committed to that, and they found themselves too bad to make the playoffs, but not bad enough to pick
Luke, I'll say
1-1,
this,
for
man.
example. So.
You know, at some point I may get the Rubenstein's ear, and I met with the one representative who didn't know enough about baseball to like talk about baseball. He comes from the financial side, right? What would he know about baseball? But if we're going to talk about baseball over the last 30 years and about, you know, if we're going to give Angelos the roses after he died 2 weeks ago for whatever good he may have done in the world and whatever awfulness he did to humans and people and all that, that's all documented. But for the team, for the franchise and for the team on the field, aside from the way it was managed and the way people were mistreated and whatever the payroll limitations and managing paperclips and all of that, I would still say, if you and I are just having coffee and having a beer and like really talking about this from an insider's perspective before they threw me out, all you needed to do was fly down to Fort Lauderdale and fly down to Sarasota, where they had their training 3.5 hours away in spring training, and to go down and see that shithole in Fort Lauderdale, that they would bring Cal Ripken, Will Clark, Roberto Alomar, Scott Erickson, Mike Mussina, go through any of the names of these guys that have million, you know, $50 million arms or $50 million bats, whoever they would be, Tejada, pick any of those guys, all great baseball players, all of them, and they would put them in this jail cell in Fort Lauderdale, ship them around on buses for 6 weeks. There was no academies, there was no Caribbean, there was no Asia, there was, you weren't even allowed to take the best players. Peter fired Mike Flanagan right after Wieters was drafted because Peter told him not to draft Wieters because Wieters was a board, we can't sign him, like all of that stuff. And this is where we were 20 years ago, that you couldn't even pick the best players. Peter wasn't the only one. The other owners did that as well. So for the team on the field to stink, I would say the for all of the years, because you talk about 30 years of stinking and the things that were bad, well, they have money and they have a nice logo and they had a beautiful stadium and all that. They had no semblance of behind the shell on developing baseball players. Now they may have had some good people. I love Gary Kendall. They had, you know, I love Alan Mills. They had a lot of guys around Jack. We talked about Jack Voigt, who was a part of their, the kinds of people that were involved in training their Bowie, Aberdeen, Delmarva. We talk about all these places where these Frederick before that, where all the players played, that so few of those guys made it through. And really broke through, or even broke through later in another organization after the Orioles dealt them off or something like that. They didn't develop much of anything. They didn't have any commitment. Peter never really understood, certainly John, Lou, whoever was running the place. And I don't know that the baseball people, Marvin Lewis had a hard time with this in Cincinnati, trying to explain to the Brown family that like practicing outside in the snow in January is really bad to try to win a game. That like, whatever that synapse is between baseball and investment and a facility and the things you need, not to compete because you want gold-plated bathrooms or airlines that, you know, have first-class seating, but just stuff that helps you become a better baseball player. I never saw any of that going on in the organization for years and years and years and years. I haven't been into the Sarasota complex. I don't know much about their Latin American thing, but I would think that if I really were having a deep drink and a deep dive with Mike Elias off the air, it would be fascinating to tell me what he found. And more than that, even what McPhail found when they went to Sarasota 15 years ago. Because McPhail really got that thing sort of started by just having a spring hub that starts everything in January, February, and March. And then what you leave behind for all the kids to go to Norfolk, Frederick, all those places is it was substandard by a lot. And I think that John Eisenberg or Peter Schmuck or somebody that's covered baseball for a long, Dan Connolly, somebody for a long, I don't, maybe Connolly was around in Fort Lauderdale era. I think he was. But like, if you saw that and saw where they came from, you would look at the organization differently and say, that's why they could never develop talent. They weren't good at picking it. But I think from the minute you pick it, you come in, it was really, really a bad, bad workplace for a long line. That's not Peter. That was before. That's all the way through. They never fixed it.
There was no long-term vision on or off the field. You know, whether we're talking about the major league roster, whether we're talking about the minor leagues, whether we're talking about spring training facility, whether we're talking about any kind of a presence internationally speaking, there was no long-term vision. It was a year-to-year, what can we do to, I don't know, win eight, if everything breaks perfectly, to win 86 games or something along
those
lines.
Let's sign Chris Benson and maybe we get lucky.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that would be the biggest thing Mike Elias would tell you. And, you know, he's not going to say these things publicly, but he's been upfront at least to the degree of saying, yeah, we had to build this thing from the ground up. And he wasn't saying that to knock Dan Duquette or Buck Showalter or even really to knock Peter or John Angelos. It was just how it was, right? I mean, that's how you get to a point where you go into a 2018 season after signing, you know, a couple pitchers as the Orioles did at that point in time. And, you know, Alex Cobb and Andrew Cashman and, you know, or Andrew Cashner, and you couldn't win. You couldn't beat anybody, right? I mean, you lost, you know, you're up when you're in that territory where you're approaching 120 losses like the Orioles were, then in a year where you went in and thought, oh, maybe we can win a wild card. I mean, that speaks to how much it had fallen apart, but it also speaks to there never really being a long-term vision. To your point, and I say this with no disrespect to Buck Showalter or Dan Duquette because they did great things, you know, relative to the overall state of the organization at that point in time. But Andy McPhail, to your point, coming in and doing the things that he did, laid the groundwork for that five-year stretch where they had the best record in the American League for a five-year period. That was really done on the back of Andy McPhail and then Dan Duquette doing some things to supplement that and, you know, doing a good job for a few years. I mean, let's call it what it was. But beyond that, yeah, you're talking about a 25-year period and going back even longer. Like I said, it predates Peter Angelos' tenure where there wasn't that long-term plan. There wasn't that long-term vision. And so much of that came down to, you know, you mentioned facilities and things of that nature. How about just the fact that you didn't have a general manager that was in place for longer than 2 or 3 years at a time? I mean, it's really difficult to operate that way, even with the payroll that the Orioles and Peter Angelos had in the mid mid 90s through the early part of 2000. So yeah, it wasn't good enough across the board. There's no doubt. So
yeah, we said it wasn't sustainable it the whole time. I spent 30 years saying this isn't sustainable, and it wasn't.
Yeah, well, and nothing sustained, right? I mean, they were good in 96 and 97. 97 looked like a year where they could win the World Series, and they came up short against Cleveland, and it was all downhill after that for the next 14 years. And then they had a bump, but even then, in 12 and 14, after 14, I even wrote at that point, and I remember sitting in a Kansas City hotel room with you doing post-game mortem radio on that team, where we said at that point, this feels like the last best chance for this era. And it was. So, you know, they made the playoffs a couple years after that. And, Zach Britton was in the bullpen for the wild card game, and the rest was history. But that was very fleeting. Where they are now, even if people want to say, well, they tanked for a few years. I mean, okay, fine, if you want to say that. But where they stand right now, on the heels of this process being forced on them by bad decisions and being in a position where they were really bad, even when they didn't intend to be, then yeah, Mike Elias was wise to say, we're going to do this deliberately. We're going to be very methodical in how we do it. And now you see where they are, where they're not just really, really good right now, but they're in a position with a farm system that they have and with new ownership and everything in place that there's no reason to look at this current group of the Orioles, meaning major league roster and farm system, and say that they won't be really, really good for the next 5, 6, 7 years. And the way that Mike Elias and his crew have operated, no reason to think it can't extend beyond that if you're well run and if you have the backing of new ownership, which I think everyone's very optimistic about moving forward.
Yeah, the new ownership piece, it can't be understated, because Flanagan could sit in there until he's blue in the face with Peter and say, We can't not take the best players, Peter. It's the draft. We can't just say the best 10 guys, we're going to let go play somewhere else. At this point, getting these 3-1-1s, right? One thing to have 3-1-1s, it's one thing to suffer, and your fan base and television and ratings and sales and revenue and all that goes into the can when you suffer that. But to have them all on the field and have them not just make the field, but to be all-star caliber players. I'll just put that out. I would say at this point, Colton Cowser looks to me to be an all-star caliber player. He can be that player. That's his ceiling, right? His ceiling's probably the Hall of Fame, but he's been in the league 5 minutes. But the way he's hitting the ball, and it goes back to, I said, George Brett, or I said, he looks like he could be better than Markakis, or I don't know what the comparables would be for any of this stuff. Ruben Sierra without the steroids. I don't know. But I would just say, when you get these 3-1-1s and it works out and you're not going to stink anymore, because to your point, this is sustainable. And they do have an owner that has money, and they do have a stadium, and they do have $600 million to come into this. And at some point, when all the additions happen to the stadium, two of these guys will still be here. Rutschman, Henderson, Cowser, whoever they decide, Holiday, whoever they decide to give the money to. And that's where the sustainability is. Wherever they put the money, that has to be good money. No, it has to be great money, not good money. It has to be great money. Because I don't know that they're going to be able to sign all four of these guys if all four of these guys wind up playing like one once.
Well, a couple things. Want to clean something up. They haven't made 3-1-1s. It's three number one overall prospects. Gunnar Henderson was a second round pick.
Correct.
I knew what you meant. I was just clearing that up for anyone listening. But Gunnar Henderson being a second round pick illustrates how well this has gone. Jordan Westberg being where he was, which is a sandwich pick at the end of the first round, illustrates how well this has gone. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And now, you know, one thing that you said in terms of you always have to take the best player, there is still there's a strategic approach. Go back to 2020. Heston Kerstad was under slot. They drafted Kobe Mayo in the fourth round, and Kobe Mayo is one of their very best prospects, and he's on the cusp of being in the major league. So there's still some strategic value to knowing how to play the draft because of your pool of bonus money and all of that. But your overall point is spot on in terms of, if there's truly a legitimate 1-1, you know, in the case of Adley Rutschman, even though Bobby Witt Jr. has turned out to be a heck of a number two overall pick. And I think if the Orioles had drafted him, it would look different right now. But the overall point is, If you've got a transcendent talent that you can take, whether he's a Scott Boras client or not, you do it. And then you figure it out after the fact. And look, are they going to, 5 years from now, are we going to be talking about Jackson Holliday, Colton Cowser, Gunnar Henderson, and Adley Rutschman, and maybe throw Grayson Rodriguez in there for good measure? Are they all going to have long-term contracts here? I'd say absolutely not. That's not how it typically works, but I trust in management. I trust in ownership that they will have the combination of signing a couple guys that they feel are good long-term investments and handling the other guys, whether it's trading them at some point in time before they just hit free agency, or maybe it's holding on because you feel like you can win that World Series in 2027 or what, not 2030, let's say, and wouldn't be 2027, but they're going to be strategic about it. There's going to be a long-term vision about it. There's going to be a roster churn. And that's where it actually brings us full circle here. And I'll wrap up my point here in a moment, but look at the Brewers this weekend. They just traded Corbin Burns. I think there was an absolutely a perception of them that when they dealt Burns, they were going to be doing what? Rebuilding. Well, they don't look like a team rebuilding this weekend. And that offense, and yeah, I have some questions about just how good their pitching's going to be. How will it be good enough? But there's a perfect example of you're not going to hold it on to everybody, but if you know how to manage your assets, and again, it sounds cold and calculated, but this is how Michael Elias operates. So I think it's appropriate to bring it up in this way. You have to view all of these players from a value and an asset standpoint and not be sentimental about it. And they weren't sentimental about it with Trey Mancini, for example, and they traded him and they got good value for what Trey Mancini has gone on to be. And I say that with no disrespect. I love Trey, but not really a major league ball player anymore. Right. I mean, go look what roster he's on. I mean, he's not. So
it happens quickly.
So that's the case. So you have to be able to manage that, whether you're talking about a guy who might you're projecting to be out of the majors in a couple years, or whether you're talking about someone like Adley Rutschman. Look, I hear people say all the time they want to give Adley Rutschman a 10-year contract. You know that I've taken some pause on that idea just because it's a catcher. Corbin Burns, the amount of money that it's going to require to sign him, whether it's the Orioles or whoever's ultimately going to sign him. Mike Elias may look at that and say, even if David Rubenstein is willing to give Corbin Burns a blank check, Mike Elias has the mind and the discipline to say, that might not be the best investment for someone who's already going to be 30 years old. So
yeah, we're putting that money aside for Rodriguez in case he doesn't, or
we're going to just continue to invest in other invest in our player development and do things that way.
Or so we'll trade two prospects next year and get it and rent another one. Right?
Exactly. And I think that is probably the most likely scenario.
Prospects you would never get at bats in our big league team because they're blocked.
Right. I mean, that's part of the
churn.
They're
going to be blocked by somebody making $30 or $40 million soon. Because one of these guys will get some money.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, not just prospects, but you might be able to mix in some current veteran major leaguers, right? I mean, we've talked about it. Austin Hayes could be not the centerpiece of a deal, but he could be included in a deal for a pitcher or something along those lines. And I'm just using Hayes as an example right now. Again, let's not throw too much dirt on a guy just because he's off to a bad
well,
start.
Well, it's
weeks.
Not even that. It's things they don't need anymore. It's you know, they have nine spots. They have a roster, and then they have deep depth. And as Means comes back, as Bradish comes back, you know, as they start to get guys back, it makes other things expendable, I believe.
Sure. And now you want to maintain depth because you're going to have injuries and things of that nature. But it's all about this roster churn. I think we talked about this long before David Rubenstein and the new ownership group came along. But I think the vision for the Orioles is very much like the Tampa Bay Rays in the sense of viewing players as assets and understanding that guys depreciate as they get closer and closer, one, to arbitration, and then obviously the big one being free agency, that you're going to have a roster churn. The difference, I hope, and this is where I want the Orioles to have a vision that's much more in line with the St. Louis Cardinals, as I've used as an example, is having the financial wherewithal, the financial backing from ownership to say, no, we don't have to operate like the Rays. We want to use the Rays' best practices, but we want to be in a position where the guys that look like they are good long-term investments as well, then we can invest in them long-term. And the guys that we say, you know what, probably not going to be a great value beyond club control, beyond those first couple years. And if you can't sign them for that kind of a deal that fits how you value them, then you trade them, right? So I think you're going to continue to see the Orioles operate with a player development mindset. I mean, that's not changing just because David Rubenstein might have a checkbook that Mike Elias could pry open that John Angelos was never willing to do. But that doesn't mean they're going to just become, the Yankees in how they operate. I think it's going to be a much more measured approach. But the good news is that hopefully you can invest in some of your young talent from a long-term perspective and put them in a position where you can keep some of those guys. The other guys, you'll get the value that you get out of them, and then they move on, you know, whether it's via trade or maybe that it is, you know, some guys just leave via free agency. So, you know, we're going to see how that all plays out, but we're getting way ahead of ourselves in that regard. I mean, Allie Rutschman's still here for at least a few more years. I mean, Gunnar Henderson's in his second full year in the majors. Jackson Holliday's played four games, you know? So that's where it's so exciting that even with the pondering of those long-term questions, in the meantime, boy, they've got a chance to do some really special things here on the field in the next few years. And right now, you know, like we've said, it's been a little choppy early on, but hey, if choppy means you're still playing at a 97 win pace, then I think you're doing something right compared to where this organization was for a very long time.
Good weather and bad news for the Minnesota Twins, who also have great uniforms and great uniform history. Saw that Milwaukee Brewers logo and the glove and the ball and the M and the B. And as much as I hated it from 1982, I had to really start to think if there's a better logo in baseball or in sports. So we'll talk about that. Luke is here. We're talking some baseball. We'll get to some football. We did some football at Fadley's. You'll hear that. We had some great conversations at Fadley's. Mayoral candidate and former mayor Sheila Dixon joined us, as well as Shannon Sneed. We opened the new Fadley's and talked about the history of Fadley's. John Allen joined me to talk about Charm City Devils and M3, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. We did some other rock and roll this week. Rob Fahey's partner, my man Keith Brewer, who is the voice of God in the 25th anniversary documentary, No One Listens, Everyone Hears. The documentary will debut a few hours before the draft. So next Thursday, the 25th, it will debut at 5:08 to honor Cal Ripken and Brooks Robinson and Joe Flacco, who's won a Super Bowl around here since the time we did Free the Birds 18 years ago. So all the Free the Birds stuff. I've released a little Vinny Testaverde snippet. So I will be breadcrumbing the 25th anniversary travels and travails and journey of what we've built around here at WNST. Even Luke's in the video. I threatened him that the other day. He's a lot of good looking slides when Luke was young and sexy and back when I was young. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Stick with us. We got some baseball around here. We never stop talking Baltimore positive.